Sheikh Ali Hajjaj and these gentlemen and friends. I think my job to give an introduction to the Venerable Gentleman is very easy because Ajahn needs no introduction. True. But I'm going to take this opportunity and some of your precious time to share some of my personal touch with Ajahn. I was, Ajahn was my preceptor for my temporary monk practice, right, to Tuja, the Jishu. And the story is, when the time just, I was being accepted to the Sangha as a novice monk, temporary novice monk, okay? And Ajahn's first class to me is Panyasuti. Panyasuti is my Pali monk's name, okay? Panyasuti. I'm going to tell you something, is there is no such temporary monk service. Once you decide to become a monk, it's going to be your lifetime aspiration. I was so freaked out, okay? Because Ajahn further added this, when you do something, you do it with your heart and wholeheartedly. You don't think this is a temporary thing. But with the time, you need to let go. You learn to let go. So this is the very important instruction to a very young, I would say, at age, and green practitioner. And I don't want to tell you much about Ajahn's vivid history that he was invited to give a speech at the United Nations, the headquarters of Facebook or Google. But I'm going to tell you two things. Is Ajahn just hosted a very successful retreat. So ladies and gentlemen, if you think a Buddhist monk should be uptight, serious, then not for this venerable gentleman, okay? He hosts a retreat at the Disneyland. He asks everybody to meditate at a room called Snow White Room, okay? And invite those who want to have a personal interview to go to see him at the Prince Charming Room. So this is him. This is again so much fun, and when you have an encounter any time with Ajahn, you feel the happiness come within. And secondly, there is a very popular U.S. I think it's an NBC show called Saturday Night Live show. Have you? It's a very famous comedy show in the U.S. And the script writer for this very famous comedy show admit recently that most of the jokes she wrote for the show was inspired by a monk called Ajahn Brahm, okay? So he's very happy today that Ajahn will come to join us at the Chinese University, particularly for the time that we need to give extra care to our young students here at this university. And ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please welcome Ajahn Brahm.
Thank you so much, Walter. When he became a novice monk, I think I also told him what the word novice means. It means no vice. But only just for a few weeks. But one of the reasons why I'm going to talk about life values today and where I got these from, many of you will know that in my past I was a student at Cambridge University studying theoretical physics, which is one of the very hard subjects. But Even then, when I was only 16, I became a Buddhist. And when I was at Cambridge, I was a Buddhist. And of course, most of my friends were not Buddhist. And so when a couple of my friends, who are quite devout Christians, told me that they were going to do some voluntary service in the local home for the mentally infirm, and they said they were going to do this to show the compassion of Christianity, I thought, oh my goodness, I'd better do the same as well. Otherwise, that they would be better than the Buddhists. So it was only out of arrogance and trying to keep up with the Joneses that I decided to volunteer as well. And when I went there, just trying to be a goody-goody and be a Buddhist who was as good as the Christians, I found out that I enjoyed that service so much. And it was with a group of people who had Down's syndrome, who were institutionalized. And after a few weeks visiting them, I discovered that they were much wiser than the people who I lived with in the college, some of whom were Nobel laureates. And even though people ask, and I'm sure I would have had to bump into Stephen Hawking, even though he wasn't in a wheelchair then, I would not have recognized him. I must have met him because we were in the same building for a couple of years. But even wiser than Stephen Hawking. Now that's really saying something. And it was really because these Down syndrome people, they had what I call the emotional intelligence. I say this because being a student, there were times, you know, when I was really down, to split up with a girlfriend the night before. And when I went into this unit for those with Down syndrome, they knew straight away. And how the heck did they know that? I couldn't figure out. They would come up to me and hug me straight away. They were so sensitive to the emotional world. And that was something which I first learned from them, how important it is to have that emotional intelligence. So you can pick up on other people's feelings, whether they're up, whether they're down, how to make them happy with a little smile, how to manage to notice any signs of people in a bit of distress. And you can't do this just by reading books. This is something which you learn by a little bit of openness of mind, what we call mindfulness, and also really learning how to listen a lot. And in all those years which I've developed that emotional intelligence, I've managed to come across a number of little stories in order to help people overcome the ups and downs of university life. And this talk, I would pay gratitude and thanks for those Down syndrome people who taught me just how to feel. And how to acknowledge those feelings, not to be scared of them, to understand them, to work with them, and not to be blown away with them. He taught me how to be happy. But in my life, there's many, many little stories which I like to repeat to you. And the reason why I teach in stories is, number one, they're very easy to remember. Because after you leave here, I want you to go back home with actually some message which you can use for your own life and other people's life. And then the story captures that message and you find you can keep it. And also what I notice in my life, that life itself is a series of interwoven stories. It's not theory, it's not sentences, it's not even paragraphs, but it's stories. That is your life. And so when I encapsulate this emotional wisdom in a story, it's something you can relate to, something you can remember, and something which carries a huge amount of information which you can't really convey just in theory. So, hearing about many problems, you know, in the Chinese University of Hong Kong, with suicide, don't worry about mentioning the word. But there is one story which I have used extensively in many, many countries, which has a huge effect on preventing suicides. I did mention this in passing this afternoon, and I promised I would elaborate to give the full story. And many of you may remember this as one of my key stories. It is the story of the two bad bricks. And to go back to where this story began, I have been a monk now for 42 years. This year I'm 65, and I should retire. But these people won't let me retire. It's really unfair. I'm going to start a union, a monk's union, for better rights. And I am also going to protest in Central District for monk's rights. I won't get them anyway. But anyhow, for 9 years I was in Thailand, and being in Thailand, a Buddhist country, you get support. But when you go to a country like Australia, there's no one who will support you. The only people who come to see you are the kangaroos. And we have to find a place to live. We managed to get some money together to buy some land. Even then we were in big debt, borrowing money. And because we had no money to spend on a builder, I had to learn how to build. Now remember, I was a theoretical physicist. I didn't even like going to a laboratory. It's all in your head. And now I had to learn how to mix concrete, lay bricks, lay pipes, and put on a roof. All of that I had to learn. And especially the story focuses on when I laid my first brick wall. I, like many students at this university, and staff as well, was a perfectionist. I made sure that every brick was perfect before I went on to the next brick. So if the brick was slightly crooked, I would take it off and start again. I wasn't being paid, so it didn't matter how long I took. So I was really careful and laying all those bricks, and as you probably would do yourself, when the brickwork was finished, I stood back to admire my handiwork. And only when I stood back to look at the whole wall, oh my God, there were two bricks which stood out, which were crooked, and it spoiled the whole wall. It made it look like an amateur job, made it look like crazy stuff, made it look like something Goofy would lay in Disneyland. It was terrible. And so, what did I do? I tried to scrape the mortar out to reset the bricks, but that mortar was as hard as stone. So my second idea, and this actually happened, I asked the other monk who was with me, can we afford to buy some dynamite to blow the wall up so I can start again? And that's an important part of the story. And of course we couldn't. So I was stuck with that wall. Every time I looked at it, I saw those two mistakes which spoiled the whole wall. That was my wall. People knew I had laid the bricks. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed of it. And even when you do make a big mistake like that, which everybody could see, some of you might also have what I had, nightmares. I'd wake up dreaming of the terrible wall which I'd constructed, wake up in a sweat, and think, oh God, I wish I could go back in time and do it all over again. For 3 months I suffered. Every time you looked at that wall, your shoulders drew, oh my God, what have I done? I was depressed. And one day, a man was visiting, I was with that man, he saw my wall, and he said, what a beautiful brick wall. I could not understand and accept what I had heard, so I replied, sir, are you blind? Can you not see those two crooked bricks? And that's something which changed my life and has changed many other people's lives as well. Because what he said, yes, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 perfect bricks. And that really hit me very hard, because I realized I was the one who was blind. All I could see was my two mistakes. I literally was blind to the brick to the left, the right, above and below, the bad bricks. And when he said that, he was right. The 998 good bricks, when I saw them, I realized it was a good wall, and it's still there. And I realized how many times in my life I made one or two mistakes, and I want to destroy the wall. I get so depressed I can't see what's the left, the right, above and below. With that wall I wanted to blow it up and destroy it. That is precisely what happens when somebody contemplates suicide, wanting to blow up their life. Why? Because all they can see is one or two mistakes, faults, disappointments, tragedies in their life, and they are blind to everything which is to the left, the right, above and below, which is always many more. Another example for you on the same subject. This was when I was teaching in a university in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And there at the end of my talk, at question time, a woman raised her hand and asked one of the most interesting questions I've ever received. She said, "This morning I found out my husband lied to me. I cannot trust him anymore. Should I get divorced?" A great question. Should I get divorced? Now I would say that these days, that was many years ago, these days in Buddhism we don't do divorce anymore. We call it recycling. So they don't get divorced, they get recycled. Which is much more accurate if you look at what happens next. But anyway, to answer her question, I asked for some more information. What are you doing at this university? And she was a lecturer in maths. And so I saw an opportunity to answer her question. How long have you been married? She said about 3 years, give or take a couple of weeks. Wonderful, I said. Let us do some statistics together. You have been married 3 years. We'll call that 1,000 days for the sake of this argument. And we'll assume, and it's a reasonable assumption, that over the 3 years of your marriage, your husband has said on average 20 statements to you which could be true, which could be false. And now he's lied for the first time. So 20 statements over 1,000 days, that's 20,000 statements he's made, and now he's lied. According to probability theory, the next time he opens his mouth, there is a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? And she got it straight away. Why is it a husband or wife does one bad act, one crooked brick, and we want to destroy the wall, the marriage, the relationship? Why? Is because all we see is the mistake, the lie, and we don't see all the other times they told the truth. Why is it we do that? We focus on faults so much. And also we misunderstand what a fault actually is. Because the brick story was told in a cancer group which I teach at twice a year. And at the end of me telling that story, there was a builder came up and he said, "Please do not feel ashamed about making mistakes. even professional bricklayers, they also make mistakes. But, he said, I will let you into a secret. And that secret is that in the building industry, and I'm sure it's the same here in Hong Kong, if your builder makes a mistake, he will tell you, his client, that it is a feature. And he will charge you an extra few $1,000s. I thought that's a beautiful ending to that story. What started off as a mistake ends up as a feature. It just makes the wall human, natural, even beautiful. And I've extended that story, but first of all, I told that story about the two bad bricks in many places, and one of the places where I've taught that is in prisons. And in many prisons, many people, all they do is see their faults. The prisoners in jail feel so bad about what they have done. And part of my job when I go to visit prisons is actually to point out that part of them which wasn't criminal, the time they weren't doing bad things. And I was told recently that there was a serial killer in one of the jails in Australia. Actually, not serial, it's enough to kill two people. And when he read the story, The Two Bad Bricks, it just hit him so hard. He said, it's only two bad bricks. It's only two bad bricks. He was going around prison for a couple of days just saying that. Two bad bricks, that's all it is. And now he remembered all the other good things he'd done in his life. Yeah, it was a terrible thing which he did. But for years, he could not remember any good about himself. And so, when he gets released from jail, he will never ever do a crime again, because he's seen the other part of him. If you don't believe this, a few years ago I get to do some very interesting gigs, not just Google and Facebook and other places, but once I went to the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore to give a keynote address at some conference they were running. And we wonder, what is the Buddhist monk doing in the Institute of Mental Health? This huge amounts of understanding and insight, which I have as a Buddhist monk, into psychology, psychiatry, medicine, which actually work. I just gave a lecture this afternoon to some professors of medicine in this university, and they were quite stunned at new ideas of looking at health issues. But in particular, in this Institute of Mental Health in Singapore, I told them about two bad bricks and looking at the other bricks in the wall, not just looking at the bad bricks. And after my talk, a gentleman came up. He was a professor, one of the professors of psychiatry. He said, thank you for my talk. That was very brilliant. Can I come and please bless his unit? He said he was a Christian, but he didn't care. He wanted me to bless something. And when I asked, what exactly is your unit, your speciality in Singapore, he told me it was schizophrenia. Now, I don't know if any of you have come across or know people who suffer from that terrible disease. It's one of the most debilitating diseases. On the outside, they look totally normal, just like you and I. But the inside, they have so much turmoil, which actually destroys their ability to live a purposeful life and actually to fit in and socialize with everybody else. It's a terrible, terrible disease, which makes the whole family suffer, and friends as well. And so I asked him, this professor of this major illness which causes so much trauma and suffering in people's lives, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? And his answer impressed me so much. He said, exactly as you have just been teaching, we don't treat schizophrenia in the schizophrenic ward of Singapore. we treat the other part of the patient. We don't go looking at the two bad bricks in their character. We make them focus on the 998 other bricks in their life. And as a monk who knows the nature of the human mind so well and understands how these things work, I just think, wow, that was a hell of a professor. At least somebody is making some inroads and understanding into mental health. We stigmatize mental health. We stigmatize depression. We stigmatize schizophrenia. And people become more schizophrenic. That's the nature of the game. So, what's your results? I asked him. I knew the answer. He said, amazing, so much better than conventional treatments, the medication and stuff. Now that is the two bad brick story. And the way that when we can see the other bricks in a person in our life, it's amazing to see the change in attitude that that can have in us. And taking it even further, another conference I went to recently in Australia was for the clients of the mental health industry, the people who were schizophrenic, the people who had gone through psychosis, the people who had gone through depression, who were still in the system, hadn't really come out yet. And I told them not just the two bad bricks, but the simile of the trees in the forest. And this is a wonderful simile because many people can understand this so clearly and it changes your perceptions of things like depression and failure. And this was inviting people to go into a forest and find a perfect tree. And I said at first, the usual idea of perfection, a tree which is dead straight, not leaning to the left or the right or crooked, with all the branches in place, no branches having been torn off by the cyclones and typhoons of life, with all the leaves nice and green, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, no diseased leaves, with a trunk perfectly smooth, with also no damage to it. And I say, if you can find a perfect tree, you notice, you find out it would have probably been planted by the government. It's not natural. You're in some plantation or some botanic garden somewhere. It's not a natural forest. And also, it's not a beautiful tree. When you go into a forest, when I go into a forest, the trees which I found the most attractive are the crooked ones. The ones which are all bent and twisted, lots of yellow leaves and brown leaves, branches have been torn off, and that's where the holes in the trunk, that's where the birds and the other animals can make their nests. And with a trunk, which is all damaged and knotty, and bulbs here and openings somewhere else, to me, those are the most beautiful trees in the forest, the damaged ones. So I told these clients of the mental health service, if you look at yourself and think that you are, as they say these days, damaged goods, then you belong in the forest. You belong in the forest. And also, that you are some of the most beautiful trees in the forest. That you've been damaged. You're the ones I like. Twisted and crooked. Scarred. It's beauty. So what this does, it changes people's perception of what is acceptable, beautiful, and delightful. And once we change that perception, again, we will find that many, many people will never ever think that they cannot belong in this world, that they cannot find a partner, that they cannot find happiness, that somehow there's something wrong, there's something missing, and thereby they can never be beautiful, acceptable, no way, go into the forest and find the perfect tree, and then you will understand how to change your ideas of what's acceptable and beautiful and perfect in this world. I don't know how many of you have relationships or married. If you think that your wife, your husband is perfect, in the words of just what you'd expect a wife should be, drop-dead gorgeous, a husband, a really good earner who always there for you, you can't get people like that. It's impossible. I've done a lot of marriage counseling. Believe me, I probably know more about marriage than you do. You only know your own marriage. I know everybody's marriage. The one you've got is good enough. Honestly. Because if you decide to recycle and get another man, you will find, and I told you before you go into all that trouble, men, they are all the same. They are. So you might as well stay with the one you've got. And women, they're all the same as well, except women have got different chassis for the same engine inside. Different chassis, you know, on the car, you know, yellow, nice and sleek, like a Ferrari or, you know, old or whatever, but inside the engine is exactly the same. So in other words, it's a waste of time changing. Instead, we actually appreciate what we've got. And then this wonderful sense of no fault finding, but appreciation. One of the reasons why people do get depressed and even consider suicide is again because of their lack of appreciation for themselves. Seeing two bad bricks, three bad bricks, four bad bricks, I don't remember how many bad bricks, so that's all they see, they don't see anything else at all. One of the reasons is because we always have fault finding in our society. We don't praise enough and we criticize way too much. And why is that? About 10 years ago now, I was awarded a medal from one of our universities in Australia, a very prestigious award for community service, vision and leadership. And you know what I do, I do a huge amount of community work and leadership and vision to take Buddhism or religion or spirituality or anything up to the next level. I don't just give talks like this in Hong Kong, all over the world, so I work very hard. But when I was awarded my medal and I had to give the acceptance speech, I gave a speech something like, "Thank you very much. I don't know why you awarded this to me, because there are people in the community who do much more valuable work than I do. And I couldn't have done this without the help of all my friends. I really don't deserve it, but thank you anyway." And I received my medal. I never thought twice about that type of speech. But the next year I went to another gentleman's medal ceremony award, and he said the same thing. Even though I was so impressed with what he had done to help cancer sufferers, I was so impressed he put his reputation on the line to try a different type of therapy, and it worked. I thought, wow, well done. You really deserve that medal. I was inspired. And when he received his medal, he gave his speech, and he said, "I don't know why you've chosen me this year. There are other people in the community who do much better work than I do, and I couldn't have done it without the help of all my colleagues." And immediately I thought, that was my speech last year. As it is everybody's speech when anybody praises you and says thank you. You push it aside. "Oh, there's nothing. It's just I love doing this. You don't have to thank me." Why is it that we will not receive praise? And we brush it aside. Criticism, though. "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're eating." "Oh, yeah, you're right, I am eating too much." "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you tell the same old." "Oh, yeah, I did." "Oh, the joke for today. because this is all about improving your life. I don't know if you've ever read a self-improvement book, self-help books, but this man went into the bookshop, and on the counter, the reception counter, there was a lady, and so he asked the lady, "Can you please tell me where the self-help book section is?" And the woman replied, "Sir, if I told you where the self-help books were, it would defeat the purpose." So I say, bad joke, yeah, okay. But you receive criticism so easily that you do not receive praise, which is one of the reasons why it's a waste of time people praising you. You just keep fobbing it off, brushing it away. And that's one of the reasons why people get depressed. All they hear is all their faults, what's wrong with them, until they think they've got 998 bad bricks and only two good bricks, if that. Because of criticism. So, in order for you to stop that trend, when anybody praises you, you should say, "Thank you, I deserve that." So when people are telling me, "Ajahn Brahm, that was a wonderful talk," I said, "Yes, it was." Why do you laugh? Because it's not done. People, all I was told when I was young, that if you receive praise, you get a big head. You do not get a big head, you get a big heart if you receive praise. So to encourage praise, please give it, and please, for goodness sake, receive it when it comes. Receive it. I realized that those group of academics in the university, they weren't dummies. They were incredibly intelligent people who did their research. They did all of the interviews and asking and finding out what I had been doing. And they decided I deserved that medal. Who was I to say, "No, you guys are wrong"? They thought I deserved a medal. And actually, I did. Thank you. And that made me feel good. As if you ever get a prize, or people say thank you to you, please, for goodness sake, receive it. But when it gets criticism, which you get so much of, you've already got an overload of complaints. So you should do what I do when people complain to me. I have two ears, so one ear to go in, one ear to go out. No way will I keep any criticism, but praise, yes, thank you. More. Try it, it makes you healthy. And when you do get some criticism, and you do fail, that something does go wrong in life, you do get cheated, what do you do if you're going to be wise? It's such a simple answer, because to give you the story in brief, that somebody calls you stupid. Suppose someone calls you stupid, what do you do next? You keep thinking about it. She called me stupid. She's got no right to call me stupid. It's really cruel to call me stupid. And then you finally work out she's just called you stupid three more times. Every time you remember it, she's calling you stupid again. She's right. You are stupid to keep remembering it. Why do you keep collecting such shit? Which comes to the next story, one of my favorites, of the two chicken farmers. Once there were two chicken farmers. One chicken farmer got up early in the morning, took the basket outside, went into the chicken compound to collect the produce of the night before. And he filled the basket full of chicken shit and left the eggs in the compound to rot. He brought the shit back into the house with him, where it made a big stink. He was a very, very stupid chicken farmer. Whereas chicken farmer number two took the basket into the chicken compound and filled the basket full of eggs. That's what you're supposed to do, collect the eggs, and left the shit in the compound to rot. It will become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring the shit into the house with you. He was a smart chicken farmer. Now the meaning of that parable is this. When you take your basket and collect the produce of today, this week, this year, what do you put in your basket and bring home with you? Do you remember all the things which went wrong? All the times somebody said something rotten to you? All the times when you got your car scratched because you weren't paying too much attention? All of the mistakes you made? Do you remember and take home the shit? Or do you remember all the wonderful things which happened today and left the mistakes in the past to rot? In brief, are you shit collectors or egg collectors? And if you're honest, you would all put your hand up and say, shit collectors, you are. You remember all the mistakes, the things which will go wrong, the times we had an argument, the times things didn't work out the way you wanted to. Why is it we keep remembering the mistakes of the past? And don't ever think you learn from mistakes. You do not learn from mistakes. You get depressed by thinking about mistakes. You learn from successes much more than any mistakes. In a marriage, in a business, even in this university, you will learn not by thinking about what went wrong. That depresses you. It takes all of your happiness and motivation away. Find out what works. Just coming into this library is brilliant, the way you've got it organized here. That's a success. Learn from that. But don't worry about the mistakes. Let them rot in the past like shit where it belongs. Don't take it home with you. And when you remember the successes you learn from that, you will be motivated, happy, and you'll be far more successful in the future. I teach that in business schools. Harvard Business School and other business schools. For goodness sake, teach that in Google and Facebook. For goodness sake, stop worrying about what went wrong. That is the cause for suicide. Remember what went right. And that motivates you. And you become a much more successful person. You learn the secret of success. But not when you focus on mistakes. So this is that positive attitude of mind, learning how not to collect the shit. Leave that in the past. Somebody made a mistake. You got photographed by the police for speeding. Yeah, but what about... I was telling this because this was from the Snoopy cartoon. Those of you who like Charlie Brown and Snoopy and Peanuts, there's a lot of wisdom which comes from those cartoon strips. And this is a positive attitude which overcomes depression. Charlie Brown and Snoopy on a pier looking out into the ocean, becoming philosophical, must be on some holiday. And Charlie Brown says to his dog, Snoopy, you know, one day will die. It's true. All of us one day will die. And the wisdom of a dog, Snoopy, replies, yes, but all of us most days will not die. Now isn't that brilliant? That's the difference between depression and this realistic attitude of life. So when we look at things like that, it's so easy to turn a person around and actually see a different way of looking at life, receiving praise and not really worrying too much about criticism. But that's all about the negativity for the past. What about the future? The Chinese economy is going down, down, down. Many people from this university will maybe not find it hard to get a job. these environmental problems. Maybe if you do get a job, the planet is not viable anymore. There are wars, there's SARS, there's MERS, there's Zika virus. If the planet doesn't kill you, the viruses will. What's the point? But you can see how people get very depressed when they look at things like that. But the story of which the title of this talk is about, The Good, Bad, Who Decides, again, is a beautiful, positive, but real story about the future. And this was the story of a king many years ago who was hunting in the forest. And because he was a king, he had his entourage with him, one of which was the doctor, the royal doctor. So on the hunt, riding in the forest, the king cut his finger, called the doctor over. The doctor looked at it, put on a band-aid, and the king asked, is it going to be okay? To which the doctor replied, good, bad, who knows? That's not reassuring if your GP says that to you. But that's what the doctor said, and the king was too busy with his hunting to really care concerned about that. But when the king got back to the palace, he had to call the doctor over again because the finger had got infected. It had swollen. So the doctor had to clean the wound, put on some ointment and a proper sterile bandage. After which the king asked again, doctor, is my finger going to be okay? And a second time the doctor replied, good, bad, who knows? And the king never thought too much of it until a few days later when the finger had gone black, really infected, and the doctor had no choice but to amputate the king's finger. At which the king was really annoyed and said, you are a stupid doctor, because of your incompetence I've lost my finger. And he threw the doctor into the jail himself. Unlock the cell door, you stupid doctor. What do you think about being in jail for your incompetence? And the doctor replied, your majesty, being in jail, good, bad, who knows? And the king walked away, that's an insane, crazy doctor. All this good, bad, who knows? But a week or two later, when the doctor's finger was healed, he went on a hunt again. This time the doctor was in jail. And as he was riding through the forest, he was chasing some animals so fast he got separated from his entourage. He was alone in the forest and got lost. And trying to find his way out, got deeper and deeper and deeper into the forest. So deep into the forest, it was in the area where the indigenous tribes lived. And they caught him and tied him up. Because that day happened to be the holiest day of their year, when they would always perform an animal sacrifice for good luck for the rest of the 12 months. And they thought, put aside animals, we have a human sacrifice that is really fortuitous for our gods, and not just any human, we've got a king. What a gift to our gods. They're going to have incredible good luck this year, so they were going to sacrifice, ritually slaughter the king. And they tied the king up to the post. And the drummers started drumming and drumming and drumming, and they started chanting, and the people were getting more and more excited, and the priest took out the sacrificial knife, we're about to tear the king back and said, stop! Was that exciting? I do try my best. In a university, when you give a lecture, for goodness sake, add some drama. Stop, someone said. We can't sacrifice him. He is imperfect. He's only got 9 fingers. Would you, who respect me and count me as your teacher, would you give me something imperfect for lunch? I would hope not. And you can't give an imperfect gift to a god. That's really bad luck. So they had no choice but to untie him and free him. And they might as well, they were kind enough to lead him into the path which went back to his city. And as he walked into the palace, he thought of the great wisdom of that doctor. Because he'd lost a finger, he thought that was terrible, but it ended up saving his life. The doctor was right. Losing a finger, good, bad, who knows? It might save your life. So he went to the jail and released the doctor straight away himself. And he apologized to the doctor. He told anything had happened. And he said, I'm so sorry. I really thought losing a finger was bad, but it actually saved my life. You were wise. Good, bad, who knows? It was actually good. But it's a terrible thing that I put you in jail. I'm sorry for that. I apologize. And the doctor said, what do you mean, Your Majesty, a bad thing? Did I not tell you, being in jail, good, bad, who knows? It was a good thing, it turned out, you put me in jail. If I wasn't in jail, I would have been with you on that hunt. I would have been captain up for all 10 fingers. So, failing a subject at university, dropping out, is that good, bad, who knows? It was good for Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, Michael Dell, three dropouts who became world famous. So if you drop out from university, who knows? That could be the next Steve Jobs of Hong Kong. Good, bad, who knows? You lose your girlfriend dumps you. Is that good, bad? Many young men, oh, crikey, I'm so depressed, I've lost my girlfriend. My girlfriend dumped me. I was so happy afterwards. If she hadn't dumped me, I would never become a monk. Thank you, girlfriend, for dumping me. Good, bad, who knows? So that means that when something happens to you in life, and don't go around and, oh, it's terrible, oh, I'll never find anyone to love me anymore, I'll never find a job. The future is just so impermanent, uncertain, you don't know what is going to happen. For goodness sake, never ever look at the future with a negative mind. Everything is possible. Why? Because you can make it possible. One of my friends is an Indonesian, he had a boss from hell. If you think you've got a boss from hell, listen to this boss. The boss called him into the office one day, put a piece of paper in front of him, said, this is your resignation, sign it. Why? Sign it. No, he said. So this boss opened a drawer of his desk and pulled out a gun, loaded, put it at this man's head, sign it or I'll shoot you. That is a boss from hell. He had no choice but to sign his resignation. And when he went home, he had a wife and two young children. He had a big debt for his house. He thought, how on earth can I get through this? But what happened next, after two or three days of being depressed, he got out of that depression and he decided, I know my job, I've got all my contacts, why do not I start a firm, a business, in opposition to that boss? Which he did. And now he's a multi-millionaire. Sending his son to, I think it was the Stanford, I think he went to, paid for it, and a very, very generous and wise man. He said if his boss had never took that gun out and forced him to resign, he would never have made the fortune which he did. He said it's so true. Some of the disappointments of life we think are just life-ending. They are not life-ending. They are life-changing. More opportunities for you. So never ever think good, bad, good, enough. Never ever think bad. You don't know how it's going to turn out in the end. So give it a try, see what happens. Because also, where depression really goes to is where you're down and you don't have the wisdom to know this is not going to last. The last little story, a very famous one, is of the another king story. A king was a young man who just took over the throne because his parent, his father, died. And being a young man, he didn't really know the secrets of leadership. So every time things were going well in the kingdom, he would celebrate. Every time the economy was going well, he would spend a lot of money on Olympic Games, infrastructure, and all the other things which governments do when their coffers are full, when the economy is going well. But when the economy or the stuff in the country was going bad, he got so depressed he stayed in his room too much. So he spent too much time celebrating when things were going well, too much time sulking when things were going bad. And the ministers and advisors, you can't tell a king what to do. So what they did was a little trick. They got a goldsmith to make him a ring, and the only difference between a normal ring and the ring they gave to the emperor was the words inscribed on the outside, "This too will pass." Simple words, and you probably heard them before, but incredibly effective. So the young king had to wear that on all occasions, and it changed his life. When things were going badly in the kingdom, instead of sulking, he knew they will pass. The Chinese economy won't be down forever. In my state, Western Australia, there was a big mining boom, and they thought the good times will roll forever. And then there was a drop in commodity prices, and many people lost their livelihoods. And they were just spending like drunken sailors for years, and now it's their car, they should have been saving. The good times don't always last. And then the commodity prices went down and people were so negative. And just recently, the commodity prices are going up again. Of course, I don't need to be a Harvard-educated economist to know that. It goes up, it goes down. It passes. So the emperor realized this too will pass. So you just endure the difficult times, knowing they won't be forever. And more importantly, when the good times came, he didn't waste all his time partying and celebrating and having projects which were wasting so much money. He knew the good times will pass as well. So he worked even harder to ensure prosperity, happiness, and goodness will last as long as possible. He never ever took the good times for granted. And that's why he became an incredibly successful emperor. Now, of course, this too will pass. You know that you apply that simple but effective teaching to times when you are down. But also, for goodness sake, apply that to the times you are happy, healthy, prosperous. Health is not something you can take for granted. Yeah, I'm healthy, yay! No, you have to look after your health because it passes. Your wealth, the happiness in your family, everything will pass. So make sure that you continue to work on life to sustain happiness, prosperity, joy as long as you possibly can. That way, people don't get depressed. They're prosperous and happy. And this is one of some of the simple stories which I've shared with you. There are many others but these are the ones which I'm sharing with you today. But I can't stop without talking about a little story to raise the more funds for Biff and also my organization. Yes, the spider story. Because I love telling this story. It never really works to get more donations, but who cares, it's a great story. There was once a spider was born in somebody's house here in Hong Kong. And the spider, after she was born, wove a beautiful web in the corner of somebody's room in their house. Now this spider was a perfectionist, and so she wove such a beautiful web. It was an architectural masterpiece. If there was the equivalent of Homes and Gardens magazines for spider, that would be featured on the front cover. It was an amazing web. It took her such a long time, she was exhausted at the end, and so she sat in the middle of her web waiting for lunch. A fly or a mosquito who would come in. But before she could even rest for a few minutes, the owner of the house saw that spider web and with a broom smashed it to bits. And that poor spider had to run for her life. And she hadn't rested or had anything to eat yet. She just went into the house next door, did the same. Not such a beautiful web, because she's a bit sort of fed up. But she did a very nice web, and as soon as it was finished, the maid came along and destroyed it. Had to run for her life again. The third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seven times that happened. Just made a web, and it was destroyed immediately. And this poor spider was really, really upset. Why did people try and kill me? I don't do any harm to people. I put a web, it's not on the floor, it's out of the way, in somebody's corner. I catch the flies, I catch the mosquitoes, saving you from Zika virus and dengue. Why are you doing this to me? And I only asked a little corner. You know, these are animals, flies and mosquitoes, you don't want. And this poor spider realized that whatever house it went into, it would always have its web destroyed. In fact, it had come so close to death on many occasions, it was actually afraid of going into a corner of somebody's house. It had what we call these days post-traumatic stress. Don't think that animals can't get this, or spiders. It had PTSD, so it was terrified of going into a corner. If it didn't go into a corner, how could it make a home and get some food? And so it was wandering down the street, getting more and more depressed. No one loves spiders. You love spiders? No one loves spiders. And I would ask a little corner, that's all, but nobody lets me. And I'm so tired. I've never had a rest. Seven homes. Imagine you built a house, and as soon as you built it, smash. Someone destroyed it. Even once you'd probably be depressed. Seven times this spider. No one loves me. I can't ever get any home to stay in. I'm homeless. I'm tired. I'm so hungry. Never had anything to eat. And when you think like this, anybody, especially spiders, get depressed. He got deeper and deeper into depression until it became suicidal. It was suicidal spider. So what does suicidal spider try to do? He tried to crawl under people's feet, under their shoes, on this pavement, on the sidewalk. But every time it always managed to find the place between the heel and the sole. So it tried to cross the street, get squashed under the tires of a car. But every time it was in between the tires, never actually underneath it. When you're really depressed, it's hard to do anything right. And so the suicidal spider was really, really depressed, can't even kill itself. So it was staggering down the street, crying, not really knowing where it was. It was suicidal, depressed, staggering like a drunk person. You know, one of those spiders. Well, I only want a bit, something to eat. What's the purpose of life when no one loves you? And then suddenly, suicidal spider, it felt that something was watching it. You know that feeling sometimes of someone staring at you? And suicidal spider turned around to see the fattest, happiest spider she had ever seen. This big blob of a spider with a huge smile on its face. And the happy spider said, "What's wrong with you?" The suicidal spider started telling the sad story of her life. And the fat, happy spider reached into his pocket and gave him some tissues. Because poor suicidal spider was crying and crying. And at the end of the sad story of suicidal spider's short life, the big, fat, jolly spider said, "That's terrible. Listen, little spider, why don't you come and stay with me? Where I live, there's plenty of food. Look at me, I'm fat and happy. There's plenty we can share, no problem at all." And the suicidal spider looked and said, "Yeah, that's true, you're fat and happy. How come? Didn't somebody destroy your spider web when you built it?" "No," said the big fat jolly spider. I only built one web in my whole life, and it's still there. It has lots of food." And the suicidal spider, this is really strange. Where in Hong Kong can you build a web where no one ever disturbs you?" "Oh, very easy," said the suicidal spider. "In the donation box of Buddhist International, Guangdong International Foundation. No one ever disturbs you in our donation box." So that's a little bit of a joke to get donations. I do try my hardest. Okay. So I hope we've entertained you, said a few funny stories, but some interesting and moving stories as well. Lastly, I should say this one, when someone does commit suicide, for goodness sake, do not judge them so harshly. I've obviously, in my job, my life, you come across many suicides, and one of the suicides which happened, again a very sad case, there was a 17-year-old boy. He was about to do his university entrance examinations, like most suicides, doing really, really well. They were probably going to go to a great university to do whatever course he wanted. Very popular guy, fit and healthy, but his parents unfortunately found him on the end of a rope in the front of their house. And of course they were devastated. And one of the terrible things when someone commits suicide is that some incredibly stupid monks or priests go along and say, "Ooh, that's really bad karma, they're going to go to hell." And that just makes things absolutely worse. And it is untrue. Please, I am a very famous monk. I know what I'm talking about. I have great knowledge of the Buddha's teachings. I'm a scholar, an author, and a teacher. You do not go to hell. And I will tell you why. And I asked the parents of this young man, said, to enter a university in Australia, they do it the American system at 17, how many subjects do you have to be examined in? And they said, 5 subjects. How many papers for each subject? They said, 2 papers for each subject. So that's 10 exams your son would have had to take. How many questions in each paper? We said, "We don't know, maybe 8. So your son would have had to answer 80 questions to get into university. What would have happened if the first 79 questions were perfect answers, but the last question he really messed up and did a terrible answer? Would that mean he never went to university?" 79 out of 80 is a very good score. If you got 79 out of 80 in a SATs exam in the United States on A levels, you would go to one of the best universities. Oxford, Cambridge, Stanford, Chinese University, Hong Kong, one of the best. So why do we always think that your son, who messed up the last question of his life and committed suicide, why do you think that he can't go to a heaven realm just because one question out of 800 probably he made a mess of? We can never judge a life just by the way it ended. There's a whole life there. Not the bad grit in the end of life. What about the hundreds of thousands of beautiful bricks they laid before that? When you put it in perspective, the parents will never judge, or friends will never judge a person just by the way they died. Instead, they would look at them by the way they lived. And that changes the whole way we look at these things. And don't worry so much, because if you are a Buddhist, we believe in reincarnation. So they have another chance. Just like if you fail an exam at Chinese University, Hong Kong, do you get kicked out, or do you have to retake it again? Retake it again, so those who commit suicide will come back. Try again. Who knows, next time. By many people, when they retake an exam, most people actually pass the second time. So hopefully next time, they will pass. And they won't make the same mistake again. Thank you so much for listening.
First question, Ajahn. What reason motivated you to become a monk from a physical student?
I wanted to find out the meaning of life, but when I saw those professors and Nobel laureates, they were intelligent in physics, but really stupid in life. And I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be more like those Down syndrome people, sensitive, and have that inner happiness rather than just this incredible wisdom in a small area. Because I've kept up with my physics, I never met, you know, since Cambridge, since I was a student, Stephen Hawking, but I have met Sir Roger Penrose. Roger Penrose was the physicist who discovered black holes. His mass theory, he was a brilliant physicist. Mr. Black Hole, that's Roger Penrose. And when I had dinner with him, I never had anything to eat, because that's one of my rules for a month. When I was invited to dinner with him, that I tried to engage him in a conversation. I couldn't achieve that. No one could. This man was a wallflower. He hasn't got a partner in life. He's totally alone. He's brilliant in front of a blackboard, but the most stupid person I've known when it comes to social engagement. And he's one of those examples of the mad professor. Brilliant in one thing, but stupid in the things which really matter. So that's one of the reasons I decided I wanted to have something more meaningful than Nobel Prizes. I want to have something where I could understand my own emotional world, really get to know it, and have a happy life. Those of you who've been with me the last ten days, I am a happy monk. I have I understand them so well, and I have fun with them. And I have fun with you as well, and I relate to you really, really deeply. Get right inside of you, get this beautiful warmth and happiness coming up, which means it solves a lot of problems. If there were Nobel Prizes for emotional intelligence, I'd be way up there in the candidates for the next Nobel Prize. But that's why I became a monk. And having found those secrets out for myself, now I have a beautiful, wonderful time sharing those secrets out with you, trying to make a happier, better world. And it works. I have incredible fulfillment when these people, you come up to me and say, you saved my life, and that you really mean it. Kept your marriage together, and that those best-selling books, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I don't know how many marriages that saved, thousands. And when I go and see the couples whose marriage has been saved, and their children, now they have a mummy and a daddy. And just a beautiful gift of forgiveness and love, which I can teach. So I just, well, before I came here, the person who took me to the, I was actually going to Bangkok beforehand, the person who insisted on bringing me to the airport, he was estranged from his son. 7 years he'd never talked to his son never talked to him, never seen him. And when I went to see him once, his younger son was there, his older son, to whom he was estranged, was nowhere to be seen. So I used my authority. I told his son, have you got your elder brother's telephone number? He said, yeah. We didn't call him. So he called him and said, give me the phone. And he said, you know me, I'm Ajahn Brahm. They were Buddhists. I command you, I order you to come to your father's house now. If you don't, that's really, really bad karma. Okay, I frightened him. So he came into his father's house. They'd never seen each other for 7 years. They still wouldn't look at each other or talk to each other. So I sat them down in front of me. And I said to the father, why? What happened 7 years ago that you're estranged? That you haven't seen each other? You won't look at each other or talk to each other? You know what the father said? I can't remember. And I asked the son. He couldn't remember either. So it is time to say forgiveness to each other. 7 years is enough. So they turned and saw each other for the first time in 7 years. And the son said sorry to his father. The father said sorry to his son. And they're together again. Just wonderful thing about it. If that's all I ever did in my life, it would be a life well lived. To be able to do things like that, take people, you know, a son and a father, a husband and a wife, a kid and their parents, to bring them together again. Have a beautiful warmth of a family, forgiveness. Understand your father will never be perfect. He's a tree in the forest. Your wife is never perfect. She's also a crooked tree. Your husband, he's really bent. But he's really beautiful. Once you understand what perfection is, and you can bring people together. Isn't that wonderful? My next job will be to bring Kim Jong-un and the President of South Korea together. They haven't seen each other in 7 years. Who knows?
Thank you. What's the coolest thing to become, to be a monk? It's just mean one thing.
Coolest thing to become a monk is basically just to be here, wherever I am. And just have nothing I need. Don't need anything, I'm fulfilled. People say, you know, maybe if you only got a few days to live, what would you do? Nothing. Just what I'm doing now. Contentment. Happiness. Just happy to be here. No plans. That's pretty cool.
No plans is the best plan. Okay, thank you. And I found the coolest thing to become a monk is we have the coolest hairstyle, okay? So you don't need to worry when you get up every day. When our own dreams and passions are opposite to that of our parents, is being ourselves and pursuing our aspiration and our own dream making me a bad daughter? Thank you.
No, just don't tell your parents. No, but your parents count also. So your dreams, you're not alone in this world. That's why very easy teaching. Husbands and wives, when I marry them, I always give them this piece of advice. Before you were married, you can do whatever you want. But now you're married, you must not think of yourself. And when you're married, you must never think of your partner. The husband must never think of the wife. The wife must never think of the husband. Nor must you think of yourself. When you're married, you must only think of us. It's that option. Too often, families, you think of yourself, you think of your parents, that's wrong. You think of us. We live together. It's a relationship. So what's best for us? You count as well. That's the solution. If you want a happy marriage, never sacrifice yourself for your partner, nor sacrifice yourself for yourself. Sacrifice for us. For us, and you're part of us.
How to release stress?
Oh, it's so easy to release stress. Tell a joke. That's a really good one. Okay, a joke. I said this when I first came here, but most of you weren't there. A religious joke. This man went to an interfaith event. Christians, Buddhists, Jews, Muslims, everybody was there. And at the end of the event, this Christian came up to him, put his hand on this man's head, and said, "By the power of Jesus, today you will walk." He said, "What are you talking about? My legs are fine. I play tennis, I go for walks, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need a miracle. My legs are okay." And then a Jewish rabbi came up to him, did the same. "By the power of Abraham and all the prophets, you will walk." And he said, "Listen, my legs are fine. I can run. My nothing injured. No, my legs are beautiful." Stupid idiot. And then when the Buddhist monk came and did the same, "By the power of all the Buddhas and great compassion, sir, today you will walk." "Then listen, there's nothing wrong with my legs. I don't need a miracle." And three times from three different religions, he said, "That's it, no more religion." But when he went outside of the church, his faith in religion just soared to heights unimaginable. Because when he went outside, he found his car had been stolen. "Today, you will walk." That's a way to get rid of depression.
Next question would be, taking our own life, is it the same as killing someone?
Sometimes voluntary euthanasia. I am a great supporter of voluntary euthanasia as a senior Buddhist monk. But voluntary euthanasia, you know, is usually when you have to have a terminal illness with no real prospect of survival, painful, you have not suffering from any depression, so you have to get psychologists to verify you're not in a low mood, and you have no coercion, it really is your free choice, and you decide to hasten your death by taking voluntary euthanasia in very extreme situations of a disease which is incurable and very painful and long-lasting, I say yes, most people would want that, and there's nothing wrong in Buddhism for you taking responsibility for your karma. Good karma, bad karma, it depends upon your intention. Why are you doing that? If it is out of fear, or if it is out of ill will or something, certainly that's wrong. But if it truly is out of compassion for yourself and for all the other people who have to look after you, I can't see any problem there. Voluntary euthanasia with safeguards is going to happen in Hong Kong as it happens in all the major countries in our world. It's on the way, and many of you understand it's a good thing to do. If you had a terminal disease, paying for a couple of years, 3 or 4 years in a hospital bed, no real quality of life, not really able to do anything really worthwhile or useful, in constant pain, what would you do? That option should be open to people. Some people won't take it, fine, but you should have the choice. That's what I say. So it depends upon why you're doing things, not really what you're doing. Sorry.
That's very new. Concept?
Yeah.
Yes, very good. A very philosophical question for this one, Ajahn. I'm not sure if you crazy for philosophy, okay? Is time and space a kind of concept only? If yes, Buddha can travel. Can Buddha travel freely? Can I ask my future Buddha to help me speed up my journey to become Buddha?
You've already asked in the future, and he sent me to help speed you up. Now, if okay, my philosophy, I've been saying to a few people about the nature of time, and many of you may have been asked by maybe your Christian friends, in Buddhism, how do we regard creation, the beginning of a universe? This is the answer. 300 or 400 years ago, people in our world thought this earth was flat. If you sailed in a boat far enough, you'd fall off the edge. And they really believed that. That was their conceptual framework. And of course, now we are far more knowledgeable. We know planet Earth is round. It has a limited area, but no boundary to it. No edge, no beginning, no end. And as a young man, I always started to think about space. If you travel fast enough in space, do you come to an edge of space, a boundary? A place where space ends, a big wall or a barbed wire fence or whatever. And the end of the universe, space-wise, never could make any sense to me. If there was a wall, there has to be something on the other side of the wall. If there's a fence, you could look through it. The idea of a boundary to space never made any sense. But of course, when I did physics at university, any scientist here will know Einstein's general theory. Space is curved. It has a limited volume. There's only so much space. It's not infinite. It doesn't go on forever. But it has no edge, no boundary. And if you get your head around that, you're a scientist. But it's true. Limited volume, but no edges, no boundaries. It curves round on itself. Basically, if you get into a spaceship which can go fast enough, you come back to Chinese University, Hong Kong, whichever direction you're going. You come back here. That is fact, science. Now, the killer, time. Again, many people feel that time is flat. The same illusion as people 400 years ago. You go far enough in one direction, you'll fall off. The beginning of time, or the end of time, that never makes any really sense. It's illogical. And the solution is, time doesn't have a beginning or an end. It can be limited duration without any edges to it, no boundaries. Curved time rather than flat time. It's only a matter of time before people actually get that in their heads too. And solve the idea that there was no creation beginning of this universe. If it was created, it had to be someone who created it, which meant it was before the beginning, which means just kicks the can down the road, as they say. The solution is time is curved, and people who think there's a beginning and end are just flat timers. And I was fortunate enough to see the life of Stephen Hawking. It was called The Theory of Everything, a movie. And I looked at that one because I knew many of the people at the time, so it was a bit of nostalgia for me. Saw all the mistakes in the movie too, because I knew what was happening. But one of the things which I noticed there, Stephen Hawking, the best physicist alive today, brilliant mind, he too understands the Big Bang was not the beginning of the universe. It was an event which happened. The universe was happening before the Big Bang. He said in the movie, and my ears picked up, and I heard this before, he sees a universe without any boundaries. No boundaries in space, no boundaries in time, no beginnings, no ends to time. Time is curved. limited duration, but no edges, no beginnings, no ends. That is hard science. Not religion, but science. It just also just happens to be what the Buddha said. But let's put that aside. It's science. That is the nature of Kai.
Venerable, is that any kind of eyes for some of those people who do believe there is a beginning of space and time and feel that there must be a creation by someone? Is any kind of eyes for those people?
Any kind of eyes.
Because you just suggest that, or not, you just suggest there's no beginning.
But people find satisfaction in that view for a while. But then when they start thinking about it and develop intelligence and actually look at the facts of the universe, it becomes untenable. It becomes a great intellectual and emotional strain for a person to have a belief which is part of their life, but then they have to compartmentalize it because it doesn't really agree with other people's in life. It's almost like a schizophrenia, divided personality. Now they can't really reconcile their inner beliefs with reality, which is like a schizophrenia. And so sometimes the quicker we actually reconcile our inner beliefs, you know, with evidence-based reality, then the more sane we'll become. And of course, religious extremists are just the most insane people in this world. And it's not just harmless, they create a lot of problems in life. So little things like just evolving, developing. You know, new ideas come up, and we should adapt to those new ideas. Buddhism should not just live in the past. No religion should live in the past. It should open itself up to new ideas of seeing the world. So that's very important for the same acceptance and practice of religion in today's world. So there's no more problems anymore.
Thank you, Ajahn. The next question would be, I have so many burdens. Do I live for myself or for the others? What is the meaning of life?
You live for us. Not about me, not about them. What is the meaning of life? Look, in my time of life, the people, they just love taking photos of me. And I just at first could not understand, what the hell are you on about? I'm not Brad Pitt, I'm an old fat monk. But in Indonesia, it's the worst for having photographs taken. Once after the talk, there was a huge line, 2 hours, a few thousand people wanting to me to sign their books and have a photograph taken. And after 1 hour of that, I started to say, this is wrong. I didn't become a monk to have my photograph taken. And then I realized that I was getting too negative, just thinking about stupid ideas. When all those people, a person would come up and have a photograph taken, they'd get so much happiness. And I realized that was the purpose of my life. That was my meaning. To have my photograph taken with you. Now I'm happy.
Okay, this question would be, cognitively, I know I should not be sad because of my faults, but I really feel sad and seem uncontrollable on what I feel.
Excellent, well done. There was one similar girl on one of my retreats. She was really pissed off big time because everyone was happy and she was supposed to be happy. She was a Buddhist, she was meditating, she was supposed to be happy, but she wasn't. So she came up to me and said, I feel miserable, really miserable. I feel miserable and I must be wrong that I'm miserable. There's something wrong with me. So I went into my office, logged onto my computer and very quickly I printed out the first grumpy license. It was on letterhead and in beautiful Gothic script like many licenses or like your university degree is written. And on it it said, grumpy license. That this license grants to the following, and I'll put her name underneath, permission from her teacher and master, Ajahn Brahm, to be grumpy or sad at any time for any reason or no reason whatsoever, signed Ajahn Brahm. So I gave her permission in writing from her master in letterhead to be sad. So you can, I give you permission to be sad. And as soon as she got permission to be grumpy, to be sad, to be miserable, she laughed for the rest of the retreat. As long as she thought it was okay to be sad, then she wasn't sad anymore. This is a simple piece of psychology, which is one of the reasons if you go and visit somebody in hospital, you say, oh, may you get better. Stop it. Don't say that. You say to them, may you be better or may you be sick, it's up to you. I'm not going to lay my trips on you. I'm not going to force you to be anything. I will love you no matter what you do. You don't have to get better. When it was Chinese New Year recently, I got a lot of wishes from people, happy Chinese New Year. I said, no, I'm not going to follow what you order me to do. I'm going to be happy or not happy as I decide. Just because you tell me, may you have a prosperous New Year. No way. It's my life, not yours. I'm not going to follow your orders, you control freak. So these days when I wish people like kindness, I say, may you be happy if you want to be. If you want to be sad, that's okay with me. You'll still be my friend. I'll still love you no matter what you do. May you get better or may you die. Whatever you want to do. It's up to you. It's a free world. Now you know what happiness is. Well, the problem is everybody has to be happy. And you feel so guilty, such a failure if you're not happy. Which is one of the reasons I want to start a society, maybe in this university, miserable people society. So you can feel accepted. Meet other miserable people so that you don't feel that, you know, there's something wrong with you. It's okay to be miserable and sad. It's part of life, for goodness sake. So, miserable people's rights.
So, Ajahn, okay, I know there's food of happy things for you since you're a very happy person. You choose to be, of course, not all that funny, but what would make you unhappy?
What made me unhappy? It's really hard to understand, honestly. Okay, the one thing which, I'm not unhappy, but just surprised. Yeah, so I was going to actually tell this story, but I probably won't get around to it, because it's a long story. Because some of the work which I do in Australia is with survivors of torture and multiple rapes. I'll tell this story, because sometimes people get very depressed, you know, when I'm sure there's many women here who've been raped. And you won't tell people. So there's a Australia takes in many refugees from some very violent parts of the world, and they have freedom of their bodies. They can come and go where they will, but their emotions, their mind, is still in the torture chambers. It's still being raped. They're not free emotionally. So there's an organisation which I support called ASSETS, Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. So try and help them to be free of those incredible, painful, degrading moments of their early life. And it works. I managed to get a lot of, especially women, out of this. And what they've been through, they tell you, that is just so disgusting. I mean, this is very violent, multiple rapes over days, weeks, tortures. It does make your skin crawl. And some of the things which I've heard, what one human being can do to another, is just I can't really comprehend it. I can't get my head around why a person would do that to another person. But it happened. So how it works, you may try this yourself or try this with somebody, it's the story of opening the door of your heart, which is the title of the first book. They have to feel safe, first of all, to be with people they know or be alone in a safe place ready to do this, because it's very hard. And then what they do is very simple. They close their eyes and they imagine a heart in their chest. Not the hearts which medical doctors know of, but just the Valentine's Day heart, you know, pointed at the bottom with a little sort of crevice at the top. So imagine that heart in your chest and imagine two big doors open up. And you're inside, that part of you which you can respect and love and at peace with. So you notice outside of your heart in this exercise all those little girls were so brutally beaten and raped and tortured. They are all outside, standing outside, alone, rejected, not accepted. They're all outside. And you next imagine a staircase coming down from your heart down to the ground. And you, the part of you which you can accept and be at peace with, invites all the others to come up. Come inside. You're part of me. You're who I am. And to be able to imagine these little parts of you, a man who was tortured incessantly with pain which he couldn't endure, but somehow you survived, to get that man to walk up the stairs until he meets the other part of you, and you embrace, reconcile, come inside. And every one of those parts of you which was so badly treated, the parts which diminished you, made you feel just worthless, they have to come in and meet the other half, to be given worth, to be given embracing and acceptance. And when they all come in, which is so traumatic, that's when the healing begins. That's when the problem is over. They're part of you. You cannot forget that, reject that. It's who you are. And when it's embraced, it's a beautiful, beautiful catharsis happens. The people are whole again. And some of these are heroes. I get emotional just thinking about them. They say that that's what made them who they are. And they're incredible people. And they don't hide it. I was raped many times. That's who I am. And I'm a beautiful tree, crooked and bent and damaged, but one of the most beautiful. And they are incredibly beautiful. They're inspiring and wonderful human beings, but only when they've brought it all inside and embraced it. It's one of the reasons, again, why people sometimes do commit suicide, to push anything outside. Yeah, bring it all in, for goodness sake. Bring it in. Open the door of your heart to your history. It's who you are, and it doesn't diminish you at all. The trees in the forest show you why it's not diminished. You're a tree. You've been damaged. But my goodness, you're so beautiful and inspiring. One of the best trees in the forest. The ones which I like to sit under. That's how it works. And it's powerful stuff. Sorry, I just get emotional on this because I know the people, it works. To be able to give that freedom. Ooh, that's big stuff. Carry on.
A happy mum sometimes would also be sad. I can see that reality.
Yeah. You feel sad, but it's sweet and sour sadness. It's part of life. To cry sometimes. Nothing wrong with that.
Ajahn, are those stories you tell real If the stories are not real, how could them help our real life?
They are all real. Every one of them, even the good bad who knows and the king one. What is real? The real is, you know, just, it resonates with your life. You can understand what that story means, the good man who knows. Some of them are real in every sense of the word, like the opening the door of your heart story, you know, which was told by my father, like the two bad bricks is real. Like, I don't know what other stories I've told, many of those, absolute guy who was, had a gun taken out to actually to kill him was real. So many of the stories I tell you are actually really happened. And those which didn't really happen were the ones which happened in other ways. Maybe the details change, but the understanding, the idea, that's your life, and nothing is more real than that. So yeah, they are real. The two chicken farmers. You can see that you are that chicken farmer. You've done that many times before. You've been so dumb and stupid. Had a wonderful week, and all you do is collect the shit and bring that home with you and tell your partner, oh, tell me what happened at work today, oh, why did this happen to me? And all the other beautiful stuff which happened, you forget about. You know, your partner does one mistake, two, three, four, five, six mistakes. And that's all you remember. Why you want to separate. So for goodness sake, when you look at all the beautiful things which your partner did, and most importantly yourself, can you remember all the incredible wonderful things which you have done in your life? Your kindness, your goodness, your generosity, your softness, huge amounts. But we forget that. We make a mistake, we do something stupid, we don't pass an exam, we say the wrong thing, get into trouble, that's what we take home. And that's why we get depressed and suicidal. So yeah, they're true stories.
And because of the time, and I think this is going to be the last question. Venerable, our government is getting crazier and crazier. They spend a lot of money building useless plane runway, but cut down the budget for medical service. And I because of the time, there's 100 disappointments, and I will not read it all. I feel so worried and disappointed about the future of Hong Kong. Venerable, how should we deal with our mind under such conditions? Thank you.
Certainly, in every government there's many bad bricks. And if you think of all the mistakes of the Hong Kong government, the bad things they are doing, certainly you get very depressed and also very angry. But honestly, why don't you think of all the good things the Hong Kong government are doing? They allow me to come into this country. They give me, I think, a 3-month visa, just at the entrance. I don't have to ask any questions. They allow different religions to teach, but without sort of being too evangelical and forcing other people. You have a freedom of thought up to a point. Personal, yes, but if you start to try and convert other people, they will stop you. And please excuse me, you may not agree with this, but the government, the Chinese government, I've met many senior politicians, they are all trying to do their best, but they are highly constrained. If you are in that same position that they are, you realize the lack of freedom you have to make those decisions. Every now and again, there is a politician comes up who does go the distance. You know, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, after the Six-Day War, he got on a plane without any consultation with his fellow politicians. He just got on the plane and went to Jerusalem to try and fix up the war between Israel and Egypt. And he was assassinated a few weeks afterwards because of that, but he got a peace treaty. That was incredible, brave sacrifice. I'm sure he knew what he was doing, that this would mean his death. But he decided to do that for the peace. between those two nations. And those are the people who come up every now and again. The Mandelas, the Martin Luther Kings, who are willing to give their life for what they believe in and for really good causes. And some of those come up, but others it's just so difficult. Many politicians, because of my position, you meet some senior politicians. You know what they tell me? They said, "Can you help? We just don't know what to do. The situations are just beyond sort of our comprehension." They're looking for ideas, new ideas, to solve these problems in this world. And if you were that Prime Minister, that President, what would you do? You'd probably make a much worse job. So sometimes I like to give these politicians some credit for trying, and to give them some support, to say that yes, you know, that we realize how difficult it is for you. You've got the people's support. Try and find some solutions. And if you praise the politicians rather than criticizing them, it's just like schizophrenia. If you treat the other part of them, the schizophrenia diminishes. If you treat the other part of politics, instead of being so down and criticizing of them, the good, wonderful part, well, I think will grow. They're trying to do their best in great difficulties. They're not evil people. Because I've seen them, I've known them, I've talked with them. There's a few exceptions. I remember meeting Hun Sen in Cambodia, and he was someone I would not like to be alone with. Other people, they are really trying their best. So please, don't be so hard on our political classes. And instead of bringing out the worst in them, see if you can bring out the best. It's there too. Everyone has Buddha nature in Buddhism, even politicians, even Kim Jong-un, even, and this is a stretch, even Donald Trump has Buddha nature.
And if you ever run for the chief executive of Hong Kong SAHAO, you have my vote, okay? And ladies and gentlemen, it's sometimes when we come to listen the talk from a great master, we don't merely connect to the master's words, but connect to the master's wisdom. Perhaps both good or bad are not truth, they're just concepts. Truth, what the Buddha taught us, is already inside you and just wait for you to go inward to connect with it. And Ajahn, on behalf of everyone who are here today, we thank you very much for putting us inside your heart. And please do come back and teach us. Thank you. And